trying to fetch food, the vast majority at the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation distribution sites. I'm Christina Onnestad reporting for Pacifica Radio.
Good afternoon. This is the Shai Rana Show with your host, Zain Al-Amin. This is a show that focuses on Arab culture and politics, and it airs every Wednesday for 1 hour at WPFWFM.org and WBAI-FM.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Zain Al-Amin with the Shai Rana Show. We're going to begin with a bit of some updates. There's a lot happening right now in the Arab world, and there's a lot of changes, and some are really surprising. But of course, we should never forget what's happening in Gaza, that the genocide continues, that the only reason why, and as we'll find out in the Electronic Intifada report at the end of the show, is the only reason that Israel is able to do this is because the Western powers are doubling down. The US, England, the European Union are doubling down on supporting Israel economically, militarily. That's the only reason why it's still standing. And remember, the reason for that, if you're puzzled at this point, why are they supporting the most immoral army of the 21st century, is because it's literally a colonial outpost. Israel, the state of Israel, is a colonial outpost for the United States, for NATO, for the European Union, and will continue to supporting it like they did with South Africa until the last minute, where everything fell apart and South Africa was finally free. We are in that moment, and as we'll hear later from an expert on the economy of Israel, Israel is in a state of what he calls the zombie stage, where at first they were denying that they're committing genocide. But now even the New York Times just released an opinion piece that it is genocide. They are saying it is genocide and we have the right to do it. And actually, if people tell me that this is not about the Israelis, this is about Israel, I will tell you that over 50% of Israelis that have been polled said that they are for the extermination of all the people in Gaza. That's the kind of depravity we're dealing with right now. And it's really revealing the moral poverty of how impoverished morally is the United States government, where the representatives aren't even listening to their own people. And we have been saying that the United States has not been listening to all their own people, but nobody believes it. And they say, well, these are polls that are, you know, maybe at most have a couple of thousand people polled in each city or each state or across the country. But the reality now is that we have proof that the representatives are not listening to their people. And the Zohran Mamdani victory in New York in the Democratic primary has proved this. It's undeniable that when somebody speaks on behalf of the people, he will win. And the Democratic Party, instead of listening and learning from that victory, they're actually distancing themselves from Zohran. Why are they distancing themselves from Zohran? I'll tell you why. Because Chuck Schumer has received 1,727,974 dollars from AIPAC, the Israeli lobby. He's bought and sold. He's not America first. He's Israel first. He's not even New York first. And the Zohran campaign is just opening this wide open for people to see, uncovering, unsheathing this betrayal of the state of New York and of the city of New York and of the United States. Hakeem Jeffries, who is full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. Somebody was praising him the other day for saying something substantive. he doesn't want to support Mamdani. Why? Again, it's not, he has seen New Yorkers support him in mass. In fact, Mamdani had actually won Jeffries' area. But yet Jeffries won't support him. He says, I don't know him, which is funny, but he knows what his campaign is about. And it's a scary, scary campaign. It's called socialism. It's for scary things like affordable public transportation, where buses go faster. It's for affordable groceries, where you have four publicly owned grocery stores that can which allow us to pay less than $100 per visit. Scary, scary stuff like that. Scary stuff like affordable childcare. And when these Democrats are asked why they can't support, they say it's socialism, but they don't talk about what exactly is Zohrani talking about. These very simple things about making a city affordable. And DC, DC, good morning. Wake up, DC. We're seeing now the fight back. I attended a meeting about the stadium that our Bowser, baloney Bowser is proposing, the same old kind of harebrained scheme that every mayor had proposed. And I attended, and I'm thankful to see, I'm happy to see how many people in DC. There were 113 people on that call, and the people that presented were so knowledgeable about how the stadium will affect Ward 7 and Kingman Park environmentally, and how it'll affect traffic, where they're proposing an 8,000 space parking lot, as if we need more congestion. Instead of presenting Bowser, now we can say to Bowser and confront her and shout her down. She shouldn't be able to speak anywhere, this charlatan. We can say to her, why don't you make the city more affordable, instead of the scheme where that it says, you know, that we have to divert money through the pockets of the rich in order to trickle down on working class people in the United States. Instead, what does she do? She puts cameras on every stop sign. And if you move a little bit, she'll send you a video of her stopping, of you stop not stopping at a stop sign and slap you with a $100 ticket. Who do you think that's hurting? Do you think the 1% or the 5% in the city, or these rich senators and congressmen care about a $100 ticket? They don't care. It's us returning from work, going to work. It's the school teacher that works at a public school returning from work, being slapped left and right with $100 tickets. It's theft. Bowser is working under the cover of Trump, while Trump is executing raids on the United States and extending the military industrial complex, turning it on to the United States, to LA, to Chicago, to Washington DC, turning it on these cities. She is working under the cover of that. While people are distracted with these things, she's robbing us blind to give to the rich. This is a publicly subsidized stadium. This is another trickle down policy scheme, trickle-down economic policy. No self-respecting economist would ever say that there's anything good that comes out of trickle-down policy. That economists since the Reagan era have proved that these stadium schemes, these big project schemes, don't work. You know what works? What Zohran is proposing. And now that we have that model, even if Zohran, God forbid, doesn't win ultimately, doesn't become mayor of New York, we have that example how we won the hearts and minds of New Yorkers in a big way by simply proposing to make the city unaffordable instead of making these, doing acrobatics, economic acrobatics to confuse us and say we have to divert money through the rich in order to get to the poor. So we have also Kirsten Gillibrand, another Democrat, getting $997,000 from AIPAC, from the Israeli lobby. We have Gregory Meeks, who was confronted recently by Code Pink, getting $690,000. He refused. Medea Benjamin asked him, "Well, Mr. Meeks, why don't you support Mamdani?" He says, "I don't know him." This is the standard answer. I don't know him. He knows his policies. He knows his campaign. These people like Meeks are scum of the earth. Let's be. And if I hear anybody on WPFW, I've heard rumors that some people are still supporting the Democratic Party on WPFW. And that's disgusting. That is really disgusting, because we actually have the right wing right now saying it's not Israel first, it's America first. And we don't have a peep from the Democratic Party besides Zohran and two others, two congressmen like Tlaib, talking about that. And Bernie Sanders and others and AOC. By the way, I'm not endorsing no longer Bernie Sanders, nor am I endorsing AOC. They need to do a lot for redemption, and they've started to do it. And the other thing I wanted to say is about my home country of Lebanon, which is being squeezed right now but on all sides by the United States and threatened. Guess what? Threatened with an invasion from Syria by Julani, the head-chopping ISIS member, right, that is now has been removed from the terrorist list, while the UN rapporteur for Israel and Palestine has been sanctioned. This guy, this head chopper that was a leader in Al Qaeda, is being wielded against Lebanon. And that has backfired on the United States, because the US envoy is threatening them with a Syrian invasion. The present Syrian regime, it's very busy right now killing minorities, massacring minorities. The most tragic thing that happened in the last 24 hours is the attack on the Druze of Syria, where they massacred people in the hospital. The Druze, by the way, D-R-U-Z-E, are sort of a secretive religion. Very few people know about their religion, but they're a minority in Syria. And they're being massacred by the Julani government, which rules Syria right now, which is allied with both the U.S. and Israel, and against its Arab neighbors. So for those of you who were calling us Assadists, by the way, when we were worried about the likes of Julani attacking, we didn't support Assad. We were worried about exactly this. I know you guys are quiet now about the Druze massacres. You've tried to even shut down talks that I did about what's happening and warning about exactly this thing. I have even a colleague that tried to shut down a speech that I was going to deliver at Temple University because they supported the rebels. Guess what? These are the rebels, the Julanis, the Al-Qaeda, the ISIS that are now allied with Israel. So good morning. I hope you wake up soon and start being as active online as you were when you were accusing people like me of being an Assadist. And lastly, I wanted to introduce the next segment, which is really revealing, very informative, from Electronic Intifada, as always. And this is about the economy and how the economy has been affected by the bombing by Iran when they retaliated to the Israeli attack and the Israeli and the U.S. attack on Iran, and how it's affecting the economy in Israel. Let's have a listen.
And listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream, I'm Ali Abu Nema, here with my colleague Nora Barros-Friedman. Israeli military censorship has suppressed much information about the damage caused by Iranian missiles last month to Israeli military and government sites. Iran's retaliatory strikes, estimated by Bloomberg to have caused at least $3 billion in damage, came after Israel's surprise attack on June 13th. Leading to 12 days of open warfare between the two countries. A new report on the Israeli news website, the Wallah News, revealed that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's defense ministry office is undergoing extensive refurbishment and is expected to be out of commission for months. It's located in Hakiria, the Israeli military headquarters in the heart of Tel Aviv, surrounded by malls, museums, hospitals, and schools. Much more is known about the damage to Israel's non-military infrastructure, and it was only this week that the military admitted, without providing much detail, that Iran had successfully hit military sites. How much damage, physical, economic, and political, did the war cause to Israel itself? What has been the impact on public morale, especially as Israeli military casualties have surged due to resistance operations in Gaza? And what might be some of the long and short-term implications for ending the genocide in Gaza? Joining us to talk about all this is Shir Hever. He's a researcher and analyst and the author of The Political Economy of Israel's Occupation and the Privatization of Israeli Security. He also was previously the military embargo coordinator for the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions National Movement, which celebrated its 20th anniversary this week. Shir, welcome back to the Electronic Intifada live stream.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's really good to have you back, Shir.
Thanks, Shir. So you are a close observer of what happens in Israel. In previous live streams, you've talked about the political, economic, and demographic crises Israel faces, especially in the context of its genocide in Gaza. Just give us your overview of where things stand now, particularly in the wake of the war on Iran.
I think that a lot of people criticize me for saying that the state of Israel is on the verge of collapse, from especially economically, in the conversation that we had, I believe it was about a year ago. That I've been very premature in my predictions, and I agree that I did not expect that Israel will continue to commit genocide and to continue to exist as a functioning economy for so long, because I didn't anticipate the level of complicity from the West. I think now we are very deep in a stage that I consider the zombie stage of the Israeli economy and society. And I think that the war with Iran was a very clear indication of this, because of the way that the Israelis were talking about it and thinking about it. And I think it's very macabre as well for the Israelis who are at this stage, no one is denying what's happening in Gaza. I mean, maybe there are some attempts, very feeble attempts in English towards international media to keep making claims that Israel is considering international law or things like this. But the Israelis are very aware this is not the case. And they admitted it as soon as this as the war started, when they were saying Iran will do to Israel what Israel is doing to Iran. And I think this is, it's a disgusting statement because, of course, it's not true. Of course, it's not comparable. And it's also, I think, disgusting in the sense that the Israelis really put themselves in a situation of the victims of genocide when they're the ones who are perpetrating it. But I do think that it is an admission of guilt because when they look at the picture of a building that was hit and in another sense, it's also an admission of complete lack of control over their own destiny. And that's why I call it the zombie stage of the economy, because, of course, the economic crisis is terrible. And everyone who is able to leave is trying to leave, except for people who are basically committed to sacrificing themselves and their families and their children. And that's also horrible. And in this situation, it's not relevant to talk about whether the Israeli economy is going to collapse, because it has already collapsed. It's just acting with struts that are imposed by external forces that enable it to continue to exist.
Shir, let's talk a little bit more of like the granular details of the economic impact. Israel is facing a budget crisis. It had been projecting an already large deficit of about 5% of its GDP, its gross domestic product. But just in the last few days, credit rating agency Moody's says that Israel's budget shortfall is more likely to be about 8% of GDP, which works out to be about $43 billion of spending that it can't cover just for 2025 alone. And Moody's, which had previously downgraded Israel's credit rating to the lowest level ever, maintained a negative outlook in its most recent analysis following the Iran war. Give us some economic and political context for what we're seeing here and whether this is precedented for Israel's history.
What is precedented is the complicity of organizations like Moody's or S&P. What you're describing as negative outlook is in fact sugarcoating the actual situation. And this is still an assessment by these credit ratings as if they expect Israel to ever be able to pay its debts. Maybe they say the risk has increased that Israel will not fully be able to pay its debts, but this is not the reality. The reality is that these debts have no guarantee and nothing to cover them. Last time we had this conversation, it was shortly after the budget was passed. And I remind you that the budget was passed on March 17th, one day before Israel violated the ceasefire. The only way that Israel was able to pass the budget is by saying that this is a ceasefire budget, meaning that resources will be transformed from the military to very necessary, very urgent social needs, the collapsing education system, transportation system, health system that cannot wait any longer. But as long as the military says we need more weapons, more bombs, more soldiers, the reservists cannot go back to work, then all of these things are not possible. And Israel passed the budget and then violated the ceasefire. So the budget was a sham from the beginning. Now, according to this budget, the Israeli Ministry of Defense was supposed to get a massive increase in spending. But this massive increase has already been exceeded within the first month after Israel violated the ceasefire. And that is before the war in Iran, the war with Iran, right? So really, the budget has no meaning. And any other country which would be breaking its own budget in this way and spending without any consideration to what it means and getting deeper and deeper into debt at such an alarming rate. Any other country that would be doing this sort of policy would be then shut down by the international community, which has happened to Argentina in 2000 and to Greece in 2007. But it's not happening to Israel because of this complicity. But I think that the only thing that this complicity is changing is that it gives Israel more time. And more time also means more killing. So this complicity is deadly complicity. But it doesn't change the end outcome. I mean, this budget is not going to balance itself. The debt is not going to be repaid. These are things that are just physically impossible.
Yeah. And does that mean that, what's the possibility of the US and Canada and the UK filling in the gaps for Israel's spending budget? Is that, do you see that happening? Is that just, you know, does the settler colony just kind of get to use the West as an ATM? I mean, how will it possibly fill this deficit? And why is it important to look at this?
This is the thing that is still unprecedented, because the United States, which is willing to spend billions on weapons that it gives to Israel for free, is not willing to give money to Israel and hasn't done that ever. In fact, there are no mechanisms for just giving money. And just imagine what would happen if the empire, the United States, would put into place a mechanism that allows the United States to cover the debt of another country. What would that mean when the global South says, well, we have some debts that were incurred because of centuries of colonialism, and it's the West's responsibility to cover those debts? So there's a good reason why these mechanisms don't exist. This is part of colonialism heritage that we live through in our world. But there was one case in which the United States did actually try to give money to Israel. And that was in a very roundabout and creative way. During the Oslo agreements, President Clinton offered Israel as a kind of reward for agreeing to participate in the peace process a $10 billion loan guarantee. Loan guarantee doesn't mean that the U.S. gives Israel any money. It means that Israel will be able to take loans worth $10 billion, and those loans will be guaranteed by the United States. So in the case that Israel will default on these loans, the U.S. Will have to step in and pay the money. And this allows Israel to take the loans for a lower interest rate. So that's a benefit to Israel that potentially cost the United States nothing. But it didn't really work out, because the Israeli Knesset was not able to resist the temptation. And some of those $10 billion they decided to default upon and just force the U.S. to activate the guarantee and pay the money. And that was something that convinced the U.S. Congress never again to give Israel any loan guarantees. So, of course, what they can do is put pressure on the media, on the financial media, and on the credit rating agencies to create a false impression as if the Israeli economy has a future. And this will convince easily duped investors to put their money into Israeli bonds. And this is unfortunately also happening with municipalities in the United States that are putting the money of the residents of the city, money that is needed for infrastructure and things like this, into Israeli bonds and basically throwing it into the garbage. But there is no magic cure, and they cannot just underwrite the debt.
And it strikes me that even if the European countries wanted to subsidize Israel, they're struggling themselves. The UK, according to the British Parliament, has given Ukraine a total of £13 billion. So that's more than $15 billion since 2022, and is having to cut its own citizens' services and basic benefits in order to pay for the war in Ukraine. So, you know, that Israel, and the whole West are exhausted by their endless wars. But let's focus a bit more on what's happening in Israel, Shir. And Iran seems to have successfully hit and taken out of service Haifa's oil refinery. Talk about the impact of that, and then more broadly, what do you think was learned about Israel's strengths and vulnerabilities as a result of this war? What did you see, and what's being said in Israel?
You mentioned it before in a previous interview, Ali, that Iran has an arsenal of missiles and has the ability to cause very widespread damage, physical damage in Israel. And I agree with you, but I also want to point out that the Israeli public is fully aware of this. And this is not like secret information. So the real question is, was this damage something that surprised anyone? And I think that it didn't surprise anyone. This is part of what we see in this zombie society, that Netanyahu didn't just attack Iran. He attacked Israel by starting a fight with a country that is bigger and stronger than Israel. And this was the real purpose of this attack. So I think that the damage that was caused to the Israeli economy is something that was very much taken into consideration from the beginning. So yes, of course, Israel, which is now facing an energy embargo, a growing energy embargo, the biggest coal provider to Israel, which is Colombia, stopped coal exports to Israel. The oil that is being brought in from Azerbaijan through Turkey is not a safe thing at all, because there's a lot of protest in Turkey that Turkey should not be allowing this oil to be transited to Israel through intermediary companies and should enforce the energy embargo. So losing the biggest and most important oil refinery in Haifa is very significant, of course. And there are other things that are very significant in terms of the damage to Israeli academic institutions and research. And this is related, of course, to Israel's position as a, or reputation as a technology center and things like this. Very important things as well. But I think of all these things, maybe the most important economic impact was on the housing sector, because the Israeli housing sector is anyway in a deep crisis. It was in a deep crisis even before the genocide started. And when Israel decided that Palestinian workers from the West Bank will not be allowed to enter Israel, then the crisis increased tenfold. And even though a lot of Israelis are leaving the country, it doesn't mean that so many apartments have become available to solve this problem. So there was a kind of financial mechanism that whereby people pay money for the right to buy an apartment in the future if they ever are able to afford it. And this weird mechanism, I don't want to get too much into the financial side of it, but it's just a way to keep housing prices up and conceal the full extent of the disaster. Mm. But what happened with the war in Iran is that India and China have both said that they recall their workers from the Israeli construction sector because they're worried about their citizens. And this is not clear whether Israel will be able to find new construction workers. And no construction workers means no housing market.
Let's talk a little bit more about the timing of Israel's strike on Iran. Israel said, you know, of course, that it attacked Iran to destroy its nuclear facilities and missile program. The U.S., you know, of course, underwrote that statement and those claims. It is also clear that Israel hoped that its shock and awe tactics on Tehran would quickly topple the Iranian government, a gamble that appears to have failed. Do you see other perhaps internal political motivations for the timing of Israel's strike?
Absolutely. I think that the attack on Iran has distracted a lot of people from, especially in the West, from what's happening in Gaza, from the genocide. We should not let ourselves be distracted. We should remember very much that this is the only story that matters for the Zionist movement, for the state of Israel, the only thing that really matters about their future is not a potential conflict with Iran. It's Palestine, because it's a settler colony in the process of being decolonized. This is the only thing they care about. Now, the timing. This is very important because the commander of the Israeli military, Eyal Zamir, has said to the Knesset openly that he doesn't have enough soldiers, and that when some right-wing ministers, I mean the most fascist religious ministers, were saying Gaza needs to be permanently occupied, he said, well, you should disinvest yourself of these fantasies because there are not enough soldiers. And if you don't end the war in Gaza, Israel will cease to exist. These are the words of the Israeli Supreme Commander of the military, who was selected by this government for his loyalty, not for his, you know, military skills. So he made that statement, and that caused a lot of fear and frustration among the soldiers. And many of the soldiers are saying, we don't want to fight in a losing war, and we don't like it that we have to be in Gaza in difficult conditions for such a long time. I know this sounds disgusting, that the soldiers are complaining that it's very tiring to kill people every day. But they are complaining, and this is what the Israeli media is reporting, that it is very tiring work for the soldiers to commit genocide. So the soldiers say, we demand that the ultra-Orthodox will be recruited. And this has become a consensus among the opposition parties, which are still Zionist, and also some of the members of the coalition. And but the coalition cannot exist without the ultra-Orthodox parties within. And the ultra-Orthodox parties announced that they will call for a vote of no confidence against their own government on June 13th if a law isn't legislated that will officially exempt them from military service forever. And I have to say with a great deal of shame that I didn't realize that this is exactly when Israel is going to launch an attack, right? This was predictable. And I didn't see it, but it was there for us to see that as soon as the government was going to fall, Netanyahu will do whatever it takes. And what he did, he told the ultra-Orthodox parties, if you want to vote against this government when the state of Israel is just in the middle of a war with a country that is bigger and stronger than Israel, and Israel is in the imminent stage of destruction, and you will be called traitors, and you will be hunted in the streets like traitors. And you should see that in the Israeli media, the way that the ultra-Orthodox are referred to, increasingly with terminologies like parasites or traitors, which are very anti-Semitic and very much scary to the ultra-Orthodox community, which thinks, well, if Israel is ready to just commit genocide against Palestinians, we could be next. I don't think they could be next, but I think there's a lot of anger against them. And I think they are very much afraid. And in the end, they voted in favor of their own government at the non-confidence vote. And when a non-confidence vote fails, according to Israeli law, the government gets 6 months free hand to do what it wants. There's no way to topple the government now for 6 months. So Netanyahu got 6 months. And this is the reason for the timing. This is why this attack happened when it happened. But I want to say a little bit more about this, because I think that the manipulation has been much more clever and effective than even just getting the ultra-Orthodox parties to change their vote. It was deeper than this. What happened is that every Israeli who is of a certain age, you know, I can remember it very distinctly, maybe the very young do not. There was an interview in 2012 with Ehud Barak, a radio interview that was so controversial that it was then reported in all the newspapers. Everybody talked about it. Back then, Netanyahu was prime minister, of course, and Barak was his minister of defense. And Netanyahu said, we're going to attack Iran. And we're going to attack Iran even if we do it alone and the world will not support us, because Iran is going to get a nuclear weapon very soon. You know, 13 years ago. But then Ehud Barak was in favor as the Minister of Defense. He said, we should attack Iran. And then in the interview, he was asked by the journalist, why are you in favor of this attack? And isn't it dangerous to start a war with Iran, which is so strong? And Ehud Barak said, well, don't worry. There's going to be about 500 Israelis that will be killed, and that's fine. And the journalist was horrified by this. How can you say it's fine that 500 Israelis will be killed? And Ehud Barak answered, well, if you don't like it, you can go to Finland. And this, so you can imagine how this interview got very scandalized and pretty much also the end of Barak's career. But this time, when Israel attacked Iran, the Israeli cabinet leaked that they had an investigation and an estimate of how many Israelis will be killed, and they estimated that the number would be 4,000. 4,000 Israelis were expected to be killed in this war with Iran, and the response in the Israeli public was silence. There were a few articles that just, you know, reported this number with sadness, but there was no scandal. There was no... And you had the biggest critics of Netanyahu, people who are from the left, you know, but also from, let's say, the Zionist opposition, who are not really left and are very racist, but still don't like Netanyahu because of his corruption, saying it would be a mistake, it would be foolhardy to start a war with Iran. But as soon as the war started and the missiles started falling, they changed their tune because they couldn't. They said, well, this time Netanyahu must know what he's doing. He wouldn't have done it unless he was sure that that the military objectives would be achievable. And then after 12 days, when a ceasefire was imposed, the way that it was presented to the Israeli public is that it was imposed by Trump. And Netanyahu accepted it. Then, and I think it also helped this rant by Trump when he said that he doesn't like it that the Israelis didn't immediately send the planes home and took a little bit more time to bomb a little bit more. And that was like a sign that, yes, this time Netanyahu really has to accept the ceasefire. And then you saw the biggest critics of Netanyahu writing articles that said he's our amazing strategic leader and he has saved us all. So Netanyahu is always ruled by fear, but never so effectively as now. Getting the Israelis to be terrified for their lives. You know that 30,000 Israelis escaped during the war in those 12 days. 30,000 Israelis escaped, many of them by bribing boat owners to take them to Cyprus, which is illegal because they don't even go through Israeli passport control, right? They're escaping for dear life. And after that, Netanyahu says, okay, I can self-destruct this whole country, and now I've decided not to, so you better behave. And I think we're now entered a different stage in the Israeli system of government. So it has always been an apartheid state. It has always been a settler colony. It has never been a democracy. But now the supreme leader of Israel rules like never before. So my answer to you, Ali, was the goal of this war regime change? Yes, but not in Iran.
Well, that's an interesting view that we haven't heard, which is why we love to have you on, Shir. And I mean, I'm going to combine sort of a couple of questions I have, just set some context and then give you a chance to respond. As noted, you were previously the military embargo coordinator for the BNC, the Palestinian Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions National Committee. That's, of course, an ongoing campaign. And just in recent days, Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz openly announced a plan to force Palestinians into what really has to be called a concentration camp on the ruins of Rafah City in Gaza. how do these things tie together? Now, 20 months into a genocide, Israeli leaders still feel they can announce their intent to commit genocide openly, despite indictments, despite actions in the International Criminal Court, despite the International Court for Justice. They not only doing genocide, they're giving us a live commentary on their own genocide. What needs to happen to change this reality?
Yeah. Okay. Well, these are indeed a couple of questions bunched together. Let me quickly start by saying that even though I'm no longer the military embargo coordinator, I'm still a very committed BDS activist, and I'm still part of the military embargo campaign. And I'm very happy that the BNC has a new military embargo coordinator, and she's excellent. And I hope that she will also come on the show. Yeah, this is just to clarify that this point. But let's get to this idea that international law, and protest, and the BDS actions will convince the Israeli government to say, we are sorry, we made a mistake, we will now stop committing a genocide. This is not how things work. This has never been the plan of action. This is not how pressure works. The pressure is on the world. The pressure is on governments around the world to stop enabling the genocide and to take action. And this is happening. This is happening more and more. I wish it would happen sooner. I wish it would happen faster, because every day Israel is murdering civilians, murdering children, murdering people. Every day is a day too late, but it's never too late to take the right action. And we do see governments that take action there. So if you're talking about the path forward, we can talk about this. But just to address first what we're seeing now with this so-called humanitarian city, I think this is something that we see this with the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. Nora, you gave us a very shocking and sad, but unfortunately very real description of what is happening. This is a continuation of the same idea of dressing up the humanitarian aid, dressing up genocide as humanitarian aid. It's macabre, but it's not an Israeli invention. The Nazi Germany invited the Red Cross to visit the death camps and the concentration camps in order to observe that everything is done in a humanitarian way. And the Red Cross, you can even find those documents, gave a report about how Germany is acting humanely. It really boils down to the genocidal intent, because the genocidal intent by Israel has been so clear from the beginning. And the attack on UNRWA was designed in order to take away the only organization that has the means to distribute humanitarian support. And after Israel attacked UNRWA so viciously, based on lies and also by murdering their employees in Gaza, they can put in another organization that is doing exactly the opposite. So the intent is clear. I think now the difference that we see now, as opposed to 20 months ago, is that 20 months ago, when most Israelis were acting out of an emotional fervor of bloodlust and desire for revenge, the arguments that they were trying to make were that there is no genocidal intent. It's just maybe an emotion, a moment of lapse judgment. But now I think nobody's making that claim anymore. And let me tell you about a brief interview that I've heard with the Israeli journalist Nir Hasson from Haaretz. And he was reporting about the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. And he was reporting about the killing of people on their way to receive food and explaining exactly how it works. And he said, well, the soldiers are armed with deadly weapons, and they're told that they are supposed to communicate with the Palestinians by shooting at them. And he said, well, some soldiers said, well, if we're supposed to communicate that they should not go to one place but maybe go to another, maybe give us riot gear, like non-lethal riot gear, that we can use that instead of bullets. And the officers allegedly, I don't believe him, but this is what he said. Allegedly, the officers said, we're not giving you riot gear because this is a war. So when, I mean, he was describing this with a great amount of sadness and horror. I mean, and not with glee. But the journalist asked him, did you, so why aren't you calling it a genocide? Why are you not calling it a genocide? And he said, well, for genocide, you need to have intent. And then he proceeded to prove that there is intent. He proceeded to explain how the soldiers intentionally kill, how the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation and this humanitarian city are intended to cause death. And then the journalist asked him again, well, why are you not calling it a genocide? You know, you've just made your own point. And he said, because I still have to raise my children in this country. So I think this is exactly the point, that reality is in front of everyone, and they close their eyes because they don't want to see it. So this is my answer to you. What is this plan? What is it supposed to achieve? Why are they making these plans? Because they have to say something. But the intent has remained the same, which is to commit genocide. But now let me try to say something positive, because I don't want to leave it in such a dark place, because let's acknowledge the fact that the military embargo campaign is still gaining momentum, is still making successes. The company Sidonor near Barcelona, which was selling steel to Israel, but it turned out that it's not selling steel just to any company in Israel, it's selling it to Elbit Systems. And steel is a dual-use item, which means that it's not always easy to enforce international law. States can always say, we don't consider it to be a dual-use item. The international law doesn't define it very clearly. We know, of course, steel is a component that you need to use to make weapons, so it's not a question. And if Elbit Systems is getting steel, we know what they're doing with it. But what I want to highlight that what happened with this information is that it was enough to publish the information, and immediately the company issued a statement that they will not do it anymore because they know that this is a bad idea. And when information surfaced that an arms shipment to Israel is going through an Air France flight through Charles de Gaulle Airport in Paris, the union in Charles de Gaulle Airport in Paris issued a statement that they will not allow this to happen. So these are examples of how we're now at a stage where we don't need to start from the beginning and explain why it's illegal to trade weapons with Israel. Everyone knows it by now. It's just a question of exposing it, and which forces the Israeli companies more and more to work underground, to hide their arms shipments, to publish fake information, to lie, falsify documents. And of course, they're doing it, but there are activists who are very trained now in tracing it and exposing it. I really want to highlight the newspaper The Ditch from Ireland, which has been very, very important in exposing these documents. Many thanks to them and their commitment to support the BDS movement. And the most important thing that happened with the military embargo campaign, but not just with the military embargo, is the new UN report on the economy of occupation becomes economy of genocide, highlighting which companies are profiting from genocide. And this has been a very brave endeavor by a UN Special Rapporteur for Palestine, Francesca Albanese, to compile this tremendous amount of research. Yeah. Really, it's very important to read this report. And whoever the listeners are, viewers are from any country, you will find probably companies from your country in this report. So it's worth opening it and reading it. Yes. Mm-hmm. And of course, the report is so important and has such an important impact that immediately the United States starts.
That was a report from the Electronic Intifada on what's happening with the Israeli economy. The same commentator that was just speaking had predicted that basically the economy would fall apart over a year ago. But as he said at the beginning of the show, he didn't realize how much support that the United States and the European Union would give to Israel to prop it up so it can limp into this genocide. And I love his depiction it's in a zombie state, because it's indeed in a zombie state right now. Thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you next week on Wednesday at 2 p.m. on WPFW-FM. This is Zain Lamine signing off.
For WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. Yesterday, Senate Republicans voted to advance a massive raft of spending cuts totaling over $9 billion. WPFW's Noah Portner has more.
After narrowly passing the House, President Trump's most recent set of spending cuts was amended and passed by the Senate. With a Senate deadlocked 50-50, Vice President Vance had to come down to the floor and cast the tie-breaking vote. Three Republicans, including heavyweight Mitch McConnell, voted against the bill's passage. All three Republican defectors are members of the powerful Senate Appropriations Committee. The cuts largely target foreign aid and public broadcasting. A massive $1.1 billion cut is expected to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Republicans and Democrats alike have warned that these public radio cuts will hit rural areas the hardest, with many rural Americans relying on this infrastructure for emergency alerts. From WPFW News, I'm Noah Portner.
In other news, a stampede outside an aid distribution center in southern Gaza killed at least 20 people who were waiting for food today, the latest in a string of deadly episodes around sites run by the Israeli and U.S.-backed GHF, the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. In conflicting accounts, the GHF claimed the stampede was intentionally caused by agitators in the crowd. Gaza's health ministry called the statement false and misleading and said that 15 of those killed, quote, died of suffocation as a result of tear gas fired at the starving people and the subsequent stampede, close quote. The GHF uses private U.S. security and logistics companies to get supplies into Gaza. Yesterday, the UN Human Rights Office said it had recorded at least 875 killings within the past 6 weeks in the vicinity of aid sites and food convoys, the majority of them close to GHF distribution points. In other news, yesterday, House Speaker Mike Johnson became the highest-ranking Republican to say he wants to see more details about the DOJ's investigation into the late convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. In a podcast interview, Johnson said, quote, "It's a very delicate subject, but we should put everything out there and let the people decide it," close quote. The speaker is among multiple Hill Republicans who have said they want more information. GOP Representative Chip Roy told CNN that he and his colleagues will keep pushing the administration to address the issue. and after clashes between Sunni and Druze forces in southern Syria, Israel launched strikes on Damascus, leading to a tentative ceasefire deal. WPFW's Noah Portner has more.
Ever since gaining power in December, Syrian President al-Sharaa has attempted to cast himself as a tolerant unifier, while religious minorities suffer under his Sunni allies. One such minority group are the Druze, who are distributed between Israel, Syria, and Lebanon. Al-Sharaa has turned a blind eye as Sunni fighters and Bedouin militiamen, another minority group, repeatedly clash with the Druze community in southwest Syria. Despite being Muslim, Druze living in Israel are seen as a loyal minority who serve extensively in the IDF. This is likely what prompted Israel to launch airstrikes at Damascus, brazenly hitting Syria.